Hello, just before we get started with the podcast, I just want to say a massive thank you to Beast Gear, who are our sponsors. Evertonians can get 10% off all fitness equipment by using Toffees10 at the checkout on www.beastgear.co.uk. So get over and check it out and let us know what you think.
And now Horn. Stewart wants it. And looks for Emma Catchy!
It's a grand old team to support. And if you know your history, it's enough to make your heart go whoa.
Hello and welcome to the Grand Old Team podcast. I'm Adam Partington. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at PartAdam and Adam Partington on Facebook. And today we're privileged to have Tony Cotty on the podcast. Tony played for Everton between 1988 and 1994. At one point, he was the most expensive player in British football. And according to the official Everton website, he scored 99 goals and made 205 appearances for the Blues. We spoke to him about his time at the club, his thoughts on modern day Everton, and if he thinks pineapple is an acceptable topping for a pizza. Hi Tony, how are you?
Hey, you Adam.
It is. How are you doing, Tony?
Oh, I'm good, thanks, mate. Very good.
Oh, good. Well, fantastic to hear from you. First of all, just wanted to say a massive thank you for doing this. I appreciate you giving up your time.
My pleasure.
How is the weather for you where you are? Let's start with a typical British thing and ask each other how the weather is in our various locations. So, whereabouts are you? I assume you're down south somewhere. It's quite bad down there, isn't it?
I probably couldn't be any further away from Goodison if I tried. I'm actually in Southend-on-Sea. That's where I live nowadays. So I'm in the depths of sort of southern Essex. And I've been living in Southend for 7 years now, and this is the worst weather we've had in, obviously, it's only been over the course of the last 3 or 4 days, but we've had about eight inches of snow over the last couple of days, so it's not particularly nice out there at the moment. It's still snowing as well, I might add. So what about yourself, Adam?
Well, I'm in Staffordshire, and it's not that bad here, but it's strange, isn't it, this year, because it's kind of like the south's had it worse than the north, which is a weird kind of thing to happen. Normally we get the brunt of it, but it's just horrific. I just want it to end now. But as I said, thank you for coming on to the Grand Old Team podcast. Really do appreciate it, and I've got some questions to ask you about your time at Everton. Then, you know, I'd also like to know about your thoughts on the current situation at the club. We'll get started then. So, I was reading, Tony, and I from a little bit before my time, you see, when you were at Everton.
I'm trying to make me feel old already.
But I like anybody should when they're doing an interview. You know, I've gone back and I've had a little look at the archives and stuff, and I believe that it was a toss up between Everton and Arsenal. How come you chose Everton over Arsenal? I'd like to find out about that.
Well, I mean, we're going back to 1988 now, which is, I can't believe it's coming up it's nearly 30 years now, which is incredible. But, you know, I think everyone knows, and everyone who listens to this podcast will know, I'm a West Ham boy, West Ham fan, born and bred. And
of course,
it was a very difficult decision for me to leave my team as such. But, you know, I had to put personal feelings to one side and move on professionally. I made the decision to leave West Ham back in the summer of 88. I think there'd been a lot of talk about many teams coming in for me, but eventually it just boiled down to a choice between Arsenal and Everton, and that was the straightforward choice that I had. I say straightforward as in just the two teams. I think everyone really expected me just to sign for Arsenal, you know, pretty much because they was a London club. It would have been easier for me. I could have sort of stayed in Essex. I could have drove around the M25, and, you know, it would have made perfect sense for me to stay in London. But when it got down to the nitty-gritty, and, you know, I'm talking about meeting the managers, you know, trying to work out what the manager wants for you when you arrive at a football club, and also, you know, feeling wanted, that, you know, you want, it's all right talking to a club or a manager, but you want to feel wanted. And, you know, I felt with Arsenal, it was very blasé. George Graham was the manager, and it was very sort of laid back approach. And you know, we're Arsenal, come and sign for us type of thing. And of course, as a West Ham boy, I had no allegiance to Arsenal at all. So that it didn't really wash in me. What I did want was what I got from Colin Harvey, the Everton manager. And when I met Colin, he was very, look, I want you to come and play for us. I want you to score 25 goals a season. We haven't really replaced Gary Lineker. We need a goal scorer. And I just felt really, really wanted by Everton. And every time I sort of said, sort of via my agent, you know, can I meet Everton here? Can I meet them there? And I met them twice. I met Arsenal twice. But with the Everton response, it was rapid and straight away. And I met Sir Philip Carter, who was the chairman at the time, and Colin Harvey on, you know, two occasions. Whereas with Arsenal, as I said, it was very laid back. So I felt wanted by Everton, and they put together a great financial package for me at the time. Obviously, nothing like what they get nowadays, Adam. But at the time, it was a good package for me. And, you know, I thought, you know what, I'm going to sign for Everton. And that was sort of the you know, the basis behind the move, really.
What do you think it says about your character, Tony, as a footballer? You know, the fact that you decided to take, and I get that Everton were probably a little bit more interested, or they seemed a little bit more interested in signing you, and they were a little bit more eager. But you know, to kind of up sticks and come up north to play for Everton, and I know we'd been successful at the time, but does it say anything about your character that you were willing to kind of take that gamble of like a new area? You know what I mean, and moving away. Does that say anything?
Well, I think you get your gut feeling, and I think also as what I was, which was basically I was a goal scorer, I was an out and out goal scorer. If you asked me to define how I was as a player, you know, I was a goal scorer, and I think by definition, goal scorers are very selfish to a degree. They're very focused, and you know what you want, and you know where you want to be in terms of what you do as a footballer. So, yeah, I mean, of course, it was a risk, really, with what I decided to do. But I felt it was the right move for me. And as I say, I just had that gut feeling. And I felt wanted as well. And I think, you know, whether it's football or any workplace that you go to, and a lot of people will sort of, you know, get their heads around what I'm saying. You want to feel wanted. You want someone to want you, and that's a nice feeling. And I got that from Everton. And although there was the element of me moving, as I say, 250 miles away from my home and my family, etc., and friends, but, you know, I just felt it was the right thing to do.
Yeah, that resonates in terms of being wanted. I think sometimes we forget that footballers are human too. And
absolutely, even nowadays, everyone says, oh, yeah, of course. You know, what about the money they get and all that? And of course, they get great money, but they are human beings, footballers. They, you know, they do have feelings, and it's never quite as straightforward as, you know, I mean, just off the top of my head, Tosin, the lad who's arrived from Turkey, is it, you know, £27 million getting a fortune in wage. Oh, he must be brilliant. He must be world class. And of course, when he arrives, there's so much more to it in terms of setting in at the club, getting to know your teammates, etc. You know, obviously, I never had the language barrier, but you know, there's a lot that goes into the sort of background of a footballer being successful at a football club.
Yeah, I got a message on Twitter off a Turkish journalist about Tosin, asking what the hell was going on with that. So trying to explain it to him as well is a little bit tough. But on your debut, Tony, you know, you bagged a hat trick. So talking of feelings, and this is an obvious question, you must have felt amazing. But how did that, you know, feel to start that way?
Well, I mean, I always say, you know, it was the best thing really I did as an Everton player, but it was also in a way the worst thing. Which sounds a bit
expectations,
silly, but, you know. Yeah, exactly. And you know, I mean, you know, I arrived as a record transfer. You know, let's not forget, I wasn't just signing for Everton. It was a record. It was a record signing for the club, and it was also a British record transfer. So there was huge pressure on me. And you know, as you well know, the Merseyside area, you know, in terms of the press coverage at the time, albeit no mobiles and no social media in those days, but it still was massive, and there was big pressure on me. And the funny thing about the day, really, which always tickles me, is that the club put me in a hotel in Southport, in the Bold Hotel. And when the day came of my debut, my family was all coming up from London, so obviously they'd made their way up to Goodison, and I probably would have. It would have been easier for me coming up from London to find Goodison, but where I'd only been at the club 4 or 5 weeks or whatever, I actually didn't know where the ground was. You know, because we trained at Belfield, the training ground. So I literally had to follow Neil McDonald, who'd signed recently, just before me, and he was also at the bar. I had to follow Neil McDonald's car to get to Goodison. So I didn't even know where the ground was, which sounds bizarre, but that was just how it was. And then, of course, I scored after 34 seconds and got a hat-trick, win 4-0 on your debut. I mean, as I always say to people, where on earth do you go from there? Because it was a dream debut, and I can still picture the Evertonian, you know, running towards them there and the feeling I had, and then looking at the fans celebrating, because they desperately wanted me to do well, and it was a great start to my career at the club.
Yeah, no, I bet it was. I got some questions from our forum on grandoldteam.com.
Yeah, sure, far away.
Bobber Fret, I think that's what his name is, he has put, he asked about the price tag, because I believe for about a month before Ian Rush signed for Juve, you were the most expensive player in the world. So did that come with an extra bit of weight, Tony? You know, when you signed.
Yeah, I don't actually think I was. It wasn't the most expensive in the world, but certainly I was the most expensive British transfer involving any British player.
Okay.
And do you know what, Adam? I didn't enjoy it. You know, I mean, you know, I looked at some of the other players that have since had the price tag, and they seem to deal with it, get on with it. And it didn't make any difference to some of them. Alan Shearer being an example. But you know, with me, that, you know, I suppose in my mind, as I said before, I knew I was a good goal scorer. On my day, I was a very good goal scorer, but I wasn't the complete all round player. You know, there was, you know, Paul Gascoigne had left literally in the month before I signed for Everton. He arrived at Tottenham from Newcastle. Now, Paul Gascoigne was a world-class player and a fantastic player. We'll remember how good Gazza was.
Yeah.
And I then replaced Gazza as the most expensive British player, and I could never quite get my head around that, because, as I say, I knew I was a good goal scorer. I was a better goal scorer than Gazza, without a doubt, but I wasn't a better all-round player. And I think it just weighed on my shoulders a little bit. And, of course, as what happened, you know, obviously I made that great start to my career, but then once things went a little bit against me, the team hit a dip in form, I hit a dip in form, and of course, you know, as well as suffering as an individual, you've also got the press saying, what a waste of money, and, you know, it's the most expensive signing, and all that weighed on my shoulders. So it was hard for me to deal with a price tag, and I don't think I really enjoyed being the record transfer.
Yeah, so, you know, I suppose it's different from each individual, but how much notice did you take of the press when you were a footballer then? Like, would you pick up the paper and have a look for for your name and stuff and see what was being written about you, Tony?
Yeah, I think in those days you did. I think anyone who says otherwise is quite simply not telling the truth. You know, it's different now because everything's, you know, Facebook, Instagram, whatever it is that the guys do, Twitter, and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, when those days, it was literally you had the newspapers. It was the newspapers. You had Radio City, Radio Merseyside. You had the locals, and, you know, there was no Sky Sports News. You know, everything was in its infancy, and the Premier League obviously wasn't around as well when I first joined. So, you know, you took notice of the press. The press were very powerful, not just on Merseyside, but obviously nationally as well. And of course, I got into the England team as well, so there was a national awareness and, you know, a talk about me. And, you know, when you scored your hat trick, you were the best thing since sliced bread. And then, of course, when you have a run where you don't score for 10 games, which I did in that first season, you know, you're the worst player in the world. So, but, it, you know, sometimes it's hard, and, you know, you get things written about you, and, you know, the press dug into my private life and things like that. And, you know, I wasn't comfortable with that, but it was what it was in those days. You know, it's I think the players probably don't have so much digging going on now, and I think a lot of that is because they're sort of almost aware and stopping things happening before they do. You know, I mean, the West Brom example recently, when they went away for a couple of weeks ago, that sort of thing doesn't seem to happen anymore, whereas it was happening all the time when we was sort of in our heyday, and of course you could get away with it a little bit more. But now with instant social media, you can't do it. So, you know, the point being, yeah, I think the players behave now, whereas I wouldn't say we misbehave, but, you know, you could do things and get away with things.
Yeah, no, the private life thing is really below the belt. I think, as, you know, someone who's not a journalist per se, I can't And also, there's a bit of me as well that thinks I'm not interested in what players do off the pitch, you know. So, did you ever, like, when, as you mentioned, the press were digging into your private life, did you ever, like, make a note of the journalist's name and think, if I ever see him around, I'll, you know, I'll give him a dig or something, or what?
Seen how tall or how small I am, should I say. I've never picked a fight with anyone because I've always been so small, so I wouldn't do that. But
It must have driven you around the bend a little bit when you've got journalists, you know, digging up things from your private life.
Yeah, you know, it's not particularly nice, and you know, I mean, you know, you can say what you like of me as a footballer or what I may or may not be doing, but you know, digging in people's private lives, you know, I think it came with the territory back in those days, and you know, it sort of carried on for many, many years after I moved up there, but. It was what it was, and you just had to accept it.
Rilo on the forum wants to know about the 1989 Cup final. So obviously this was about 5 weeks after the Hillsborough disaster. Given the circumstances, yeah. Tony, what was the feeling among the squad before the game?
It wasn't any different from the point of view that quite obviously we wanted to win the match. You know, the Everton playing against Liverpool was always a massive game, and particularly and probably more so for the local boys that were in the squad at the time. It was always meant a little bit more to them, which is understandable. But you know, our approach to the game wasn't any different. It wasn't it's the Hillsborough and Liverpool deserve to win it because of what happened type of thing. It was basically that, you know, we went out to try and win the game, and you know, I don't think Liverpool would have expected any else, and our fans certainly wouldn't have expected anything else. There was nothing different in our approach, but you just, you know, I think I got the impression that it was just sort of it was almost meant to be for Liverpool that particular year. You know, it was a fantastic final. I'm so proud and pleased to say that I played in an FA Cup final. It was my one and only appearance in an FA Cup final. Obviously, I'd like it to have been in different circumstances, though, that goes without saying. But, you know, the one thing I look back on the day was just how poor my performance was. I just didn't play very well. I don't know whether it was just exhaustion at the end of a long season and a lot of, you know, a very high-pressured season for me. It was a hot day at Wembley, and you know, I played the whole 120 minutes. You know, Colin never took me off, but I just didn't play very well. And I think Alan Hansen played that day, and he pretty much had me in his pocket. And that, you know, I look back and think I wish I'd have played better. You know, certainly for myself and for the Evertonians that were at the, you know, that were watching around the world. But it just was what it was, and obviously it was just meant to be that Liverpool were going to win it that year.
Yeah, of course. Azza wants to know if you think there's a difference between like the attitude of the modern player now than, you know, than your time. Do you see any stark differences between, you know, the way that players approach the game now? How have things changed in your mind?
I don't think we've got enough time in this podcast to answer that one.
I've only got you for about 20 minutes, so no.
I think there is a, you know, it's... I think the whole game has changed, and I always answer that question with trying to think of something that is the same as when I played, you know, because I'm talking about pitches, I'm talking about stadiums, I'm talking about the kits, I'm talking about the diet, I'm talking about the wages, you know, everything has changed dramatically. And as a result of that, players' attitudes have changed. It's much more of a international game now, you know, but Stefan Rennie was a Swede, we had Ray Atterveld, who was a Dutchman, but they were just coming into the game. But, you know, the definition of a foreigner was a Welshman, Neville Southall, and, you know, a Scotsman and an Irishman, really. That was your international player. So, you know, football was very different. I think the one thing I can think of is the ball was round. And that's a, you know, we wore boots, but obviously the boots are different now. The balls are different. You know what I mean? So it's everything is different. And as a result of everything changing in football, then, as I said, the Premier League came in 92 during my Everton days. And, you know, as a result of that, I think everything's changed. So you can't compare. I think it's just it's a completely different football game now.
Do you keep in contact with any of your old teammates from that Everton side?
Yeah, I do. I keep in touch with Neil McDonald, Peter Beagrey. I speak to. Sorry, I'm just sneezing. It must be that cold weather I was talking about. I'm probably best friends in terms of my Everton pals with Neil McDonald. I think I speak to him more than most of the others. Stuart McCall, obviously, with the players that I signed at the time, really. Stuart McCall, Pat Nevin, I see every now and again. And as I said, Peter Beagrey. But, you know, I think with football, you make friends that remain your friends for life, but you have very various degrees of friendship with people. You know, obviously, you have your close friends, your school friends, etc., that you grow up with, and they stay with you and they follow you all around wherever you might be. And then, of course, you've got your football mates who are sometimes your acquaintances. And, you know, let's be honest here, sometimes you don't get on with some of your teammates, so you're not going to be friends with everyone. There's 25 men all trying to sort of get the glory and win the games and score the goals, etc. But yeah, I'd like to think that I've got, you know, a good 3 or 4 or 5 players that I sort of keep in touch with. And what I would add as well is when I go back to Goodison, which is not too often nowadays, but I was back for the West Ham game back in October, November last year, and I bumped into the likes of Ian Snodding, Graham Stewart, Graham Sharp, and, you know, it's nice to catch up with old teammates like that as well, who I don't regularly speak to, but it's nice to see them.
Yeah, Graham Sharp and Graham Stewart are two terrific guys. I've interviewed them, you know, doing this stuff, and yeah, I've got a lot of time for them both. They're really lovely. West Ham's your club, then. We know that. Everybody knows that's no secret. So you know all about Big Sam. I did a poll at lunchtime on our Instagram feed on the stories segment there, and I said, like, would you be happy with Big Sam in charge next season? And 93% of Evertonians said no, they wouldn't. Do you think that football fans are a little bit harsh sometimes?
Well, what I would say, Adam, I would say that I think that West Ham and Everton are very similar football clubs. I think Everton obviously is the slightly larger club. I think we all would accept that. But in terms of their fan base, in terms of their personalities, in terms of their football knowledge, I think they're very, very similar. And the point I'm making, I always say West Ham fans are very knowledgeable about football. And the same applies to Everton fans. Everton fans know their football, you know, and you can't kid a kidder, as they say. I think the Evertonians are looking at it, and it's all a bit perplexing, really. I mean, as I said to you, I'm looking in from, you know, many, many miles away, so I don't get to hear and see everything that's going on at Goodison. But it almost seems to me that the club pressed the panic button, as in getting rid of Koeman. They then desperately, desperately wanted David Unsworth, as I did as well, to be successful in that managerial role. And then Everton walloped West Ham, didn't they, 4-0 on that night that I was there. And obviously then Big Sam was appointed. And the thing is with Big Sam, and, you know, we had it at West Ham, and, you know, you could say before then at Blackburns, Newcastle, Boltons and Crystal Palace, you know, any team he's managed, you know, Sam does what Sam does. You know, Sam will not change. You can't appoint Sam at that Allardyce and then moan about what he does, because everyone knows what he's going to do. And I said at the time, I said, if you appoint Sam, you know, I think Everton were, to be fair, they were still in relegation trouble when he took over. When you appoint Big Sam, he will get you out of relegation trouble. What he will do the following season is he'll probably get you to finish about 10th. And then the following season, you'll probably finish 9th. And along the way, you'll get some good games, you'll get some bad games. The football won't be particularly attractive, because Sam's teams have never been particularly attractive. But you won't get relegated. And that's what Sam does. So I don't think anyone should be surprised with what's gone on, you know, because it is what it is, and it's not going to change. And, you know, whether the board will consider, you know, changing at the end of the season or whatever, I don't know. And then, of course, you then, you know, got to think about, well, it's all right getting rid of Big Sam, but you don't want to get some flavour of the month continental manager who comes in and all of a sudden, you know, you're in relegation trouble again, and then everyone will be saying, hold on, we need a Sam Allardyce. So I think you've just got to be a little bit careful. I understand what the Evertonians want, and they want a certain brand of football. I get that. I think you've got to move Sam on at the right time. You know, I mean, listen, is he educating Duncan Ferguson? Is he educating David Unsworth, for example, to help them to become managers? so that maybe they can take over, because I think something like that would be a good idea. But I don't know what's going on behind the scenes, but I understand the frustration of the Evertonians.
Yeah, I just think with Sam, just quickly on this, you know, I kind of thought when he came in, I gave him the benefit of the doubt, and I thought, well, this is an opportunity for him to potentially kind of change that reputation that he's got, you know, with a club like Everton and resources.
Well, it's the biggest club he's been at, Adam, but he was never going to change. You know, no. Sam only knows one way. His managerial style, the way his teams play football, the sort of player he looks to buy and gets involved in, when he's got players, how they play, how he plays them, that was never going to change. And, you know, I think maybe it was wishful thinking from yourself that it was going to change. But, you know, Sam does what it says on the tin. That, you know, the Sam Allardyce tin, he does what it says, and you don't get relegated under Big Sam. So I think we're just going to have to wait and see what happens, because if the fans get more and more restless and more unhappy, then obviously the board will have to look at the situation. But, you know, it's certainly been a frustrating few, you know, certainly the last couple of months in terms of some of the results I've had.
Yeah. Two quick questions, Tony, and then I'll let you go, because I've already taken up 5 minutes more than I think.
No rush, Adam, honestly. No rush. When I put the phone down, I'm only going to have to watch Tottenham play in the FA Cup, so there's no rush.
Oh, okay. If you're not, I don't know whether you'd have like a Netflix series on the go or something, but of course it's...
No, I don't watch Netflix. No, I'd love to say I know how Netflix works, but I'm not up on modern technology.
Okay, fair enough. So if Farhan Mashiri's been at the club now for 2 years, I think it's 2 years today, I think, and he obviously, you know, it's been a bit of a strange one. We've made some progress, and then some could argue that there's areas that we potentially haven't. If you were brought in as this advisor, Tony, what kind of things would you be saying to him about the next 2 years?
Well, I had the pleasure of meeting Fahad Mashiri at the train station about 18 months ago. He'd just taken over at Everton, and I was introduced to him. I was at Euston going to, Birmingham, and he was with a friend of mine going up to Goodison, and I got introduced, and he said, what's happening with my team? And I just said to him, I said, I think you need some defenders. And that's what I said to him. And that was 18 months ago, and I think Jordan Pickford's a good signing for the club. You know, he's a good goalkeeper, but I think defensively, I think things have been a little bit unsettled. Obviously, Jagger's coming to the end of his career. Ashley Williams as well.
Tony, did you recommend Ashley Williams? Is that what happened here?
No, I didn't. I said it was a general defensively. You need to sort things out. I didn't recommend Ashley Williams. I just want to clarify that. but I think obviously the club needs to sort out the defensive side of things just to get a settled back four in that, you know, that are trusted and perhaps are a little bit more youthful than some of the boys that are there now. And then you then got to get the balance right. You know, a centre forward to replace Lukaku was obvious. And I think you probably needed a bit more pace in the team. But obviously with Walcott arriving now, you do get a little bit of pace with him. So I just think there's an imbalance with the squad. And I think that's something for either Big Sam or whoever is in charge in the summer to get right, you know, get the balance right in the squad. And, you know, Everton aren't too far away. You know, they have got some good players there, but they do need to get the balance of the squad right. But listen, that applies to probably 10, 12 of the 20 Premier League teams at the moment. So Everton aren't alone in that.
No. And one final big question. This one's probably the toughest one, Tony. Is pineapple an acceptable topping on a pizza?
Who's asked that one? Is that you? Or has someone actually come up with that as a question?
It's a general question that gets poised.
I love pineapple on a pizza. But you get the old Hawaiian pizza, I think it's called.
Do you like it?
A little bit of ham, a little bit of pineapple. I love pineapple. It's a lovely fruit. So, yeah, I don't mind pineapple on the pizza.
I agree.
I wouldn't have it on every pizza that I have, but certainly on some of it, it's fine.
Okay, good. I'm glad we've clarified that. Okay then, Tony. So what are you up to now? Where can people find you and listen to your thoughts on the football?
Well, as I said, Anna, I'm not really up with all the modern technology. I am on Twitter at TonyCotty9 is my Twitter handle. I don't post too much, so I wouldn't rush to follow me on Twitter because you won't see too much on there. Apparently, I'm on Instagram as well, but I wouldn't even know how to go on Instagram. So I've got friends and family around me who keep an eye on things and that. I would say the main place to sort of, if you want to see me or hear me, is to tune into Sky Sports every weekend, and you'll see me at some far-flung place looking freezing cold and commentating on a football match. So I've been doing Sky for 16 years now, and it's a great job. It's not obviously playing, it's not obviously managing or coaching, but it's the next best thing after that. And, you know, I've thoroughly enjoyed my time there. So, you know, you can watch me on Sky Sports.
Yeah, yeah. I think you're always cracking on that. So, and I do see you every now and again, as you say, freezing in the stands of some stadium up north. So, yeah, look, thank you for coming on again. Really, really appreciate it, Tony. You've been fantastic, and thank you for answering. Thank you for answering the question. So, thank you to our sponsor, Beast Gear. Head over to www.beastgear.co.uk and use the code TOFFEES10 for a 10% discount to boost your goals. Also, remember to sign up to Grand Old Team if you haven't. I'm Adam Partington. Thanks again, Tony.
It's a grand old team to play for. It's a grand old team to support. And if you know your history, it's enough to make your heart go. Whoa.